2016 has barely gotten started, and already my pal Samantha Hunt's new novel, Mr. Splitfoot, is one of my favorite books of the year. The novel is fantastic and fantastical. Part ghost story, part twisted tale of a cult, part crazy road trip. It's about love and motherhood and the wish we all have to make sense of the senseless. The book follows Ruth and Nat, 17-year-old orphans raised by an abusive zealot at an orphanage. The place is called Love of Christ! Exclamation point. The kids' great comfort is their knack for talking to the dead. Then, a decade or so later, more or less in the present day, Ruth and her niece Cora, who is single, pregnant, and adrift, make their way across upstate New York on a mysterious quest. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, what was the germ of this story?
I think... So, I'd have to say that the earliest stirrings of this book happened when I was about 6 years old, and there's a ghost story in it, The Vanishing Hitchhiker, which probably everybody knows.
Well, that, there are many ghost stories.
Many ghost stories in the book.
One.
But that one in particular, which when I was 6 years old, Honeycomb cereal printed on the back of the cereal box a copy of that you could cut out for Halloween. And I cut it out. And I'd say that was probably the earliest start of this book. So, you know, 38 years later.
So sugary cereal and and being spooked.
And
came
being
together.
Scared. Being scared. Yep.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
So that memory of that cereal box 30 odd years ago inspired you to write this book?
I began with that story. I was also at the time pregnant with twins, and I really just wanted to go for a long walk, and I actually couldn't. I mean, I really couldn't even walk to the end of my driveway being pregnant with twins. And so for me, a lot of the book was during that pregnancy, just this idea of, wow, oh, walking is the ultimate freedom, just leaving your house one day and not coming back. That seemed amazing to me.
Which happens in the book. And it really germinated out of the twins germinating in you, essentially?
Yes.
And speaking of twins, I mean, I've always thought getting pregnant is the most supernatural thing that can happen to a human being in real life. Twins is like really supernatural.
Absolutely. And that would I say is the third story here that started the book, is the idea of motherhood. And I had a 2-year-old and found out that I was 4 months pregnant with twins. And so motherhood came on really, really hard for me, I'd say, very, very swiftly. Not hard in you know, I love it, obviously.
Sure.
But hard in, came down heavy in a big way. And approaching the book, like, things that I'd heard about motherhood were so cliche and so wrong and so not my experience.
Give me an example.
That it's about making broccoli and chicken breasts. It's about driving a minivan.
It's... Eventually, it's all that, too.
Much of it, that
the,
seems...
The deep, weird... Yeah.
Yeah. The what you said, the total supernatural phenomenon of making a person in your body and then the person starts talking to you.
Yes.
My kids are older now and I can't believe it.
Will you read a bit of from Mr. Splitfoot before we talk more?
Sure. So this is where Ruth and Nat meet for the first time when they're quite young. Ruth's sister Elle has aged out of the group home and she is replaced with Nat. Ruth said nothing for 2 weeks. No one noticed. Eventually, the state brought the father a replacement, a boy named Nat who'd had trouble with matches and kerosene. The word became flesh and lived among them. "You can be my sister now," Ruth told him. That was the word. Nat was also 5, small enough to stuff inside the tall white garbage bag of clothes he carried. "All right," he agreed. "Sisters." Nat moved into the room Ruth had shared with Elle. Didn't even change the sheets. One twin bed. They slept foot to face. 2 heads on 1 body, joined like a knave card. Sisters. Ruth grew. Nat grew. The bed stayed small. Her hair got longer. His beauty sharpened like a vampire's. And while the father was distracted by meditations on his messiahhood, fantasizing his interview with Rolling Stone magazine and Oprah, some dewy bridge a bundled corpus callosum, metastasized between the person of Nat and the person of Ruth.
That was Samantha Hunt reading from her novel, Mr. Splitfoot. So the two stories of a little time ago, these two friends, boy and girl, and then more or less present day, one of them grown up and her niece, they play out side by side in alternating chapters. Originally, you wanted to have them be independent demi-books bound together, and you'd read one and then the next?
Yeah. No, so you would start one book on this side, read one chapter, flip the book over.
Oh, so it would be read the same way.
Read the same way, uh-huh. But in the process of flipping the book so that both books would meet in the middle and end in the middle. I like that idea simply because when I was young, I was a bookmaker.
Literally a bookmaker.
Yeah, an actual
you
bookmaker.
You didn't take bets.
In artist books. No. Oh, yeah. I wish. In my next life, that's going to be the bookmaking I'll do. And both narratives are climbing up a mountain in the Adirondacks. And I thought, oh, that's a lovely image of them meeting in the middle of this mountain.
And you decided it was too tricky and stunty, or just it was too hard to do?
Publishing house decided it was too tricky and stunty.
Uh-huh.
No, I still have fantasies of it being printed that way someday.
The older version of Ruth, who begins as this kid in half the book and then is old, is mute. Why did you want a character who didn't speak?
The idea to make her mute came out of a deep interest I have in the singer Linda Thompson and how she lost her voice after her...
In like the 80s?
When she and Richard Thompson were breaking up, she lost her voice, couldn't sing for 11 years. Also, my great-grandmother lost her voice for her entire life. Her first child died, and she never spoke again for, 60 years. And so that idea of a mute woman, a silent woman, and what that means, I mean, there's many examples. Maya Angelou lost her voice for years when she was a child after trauma. And I thought, oh, wow, that voiceless woman is very powerful to me. And I set myself the challenge. What if I could create a character who can't talk? How would she communicate in a book?
Well, you set yourself a lot of challenges in this book, like the religious sect you invent called the Etherists, where you not only invented their religion, but wrote their holy text.
I did. I made up the religion. As I started to do the research for this book, I had recently left the city, moved upstate to upstate New York, and I started researching all the different religions that had started there, Mormonism, spiritualism.
The big Shaker community nearby.
The Shaker community, the Millerites. There's so many religious communities in upstate New York.
No, the 19th century in upstate New York was a place of miracles, wonders, and insane people.
But I love that about it. I love the kind of aspirational Americanism of that.
Yep.
It feels like capitalism to me in terms of religion. And I think that there's something humorous about that.
Yes.
And I said, I'm going to try to do what Joseph Smith did and borrowed from the Book of Mormon to create the Book of Ether, borrowed from Carl Sagan's Cosmos, another person who inspired me a lot as a child. And so I kind of just thought, why don't take everything that I love? I'll take my fascination with Mormons. I'll take my love of vinyl records. I'll take,
you can be
Carl
random
Sagan.
Too.
Yeah, I'll take Carl Sagan and see if I can build a religion around these things that I value. And the idea of the meteorites. I studied geology in undergrad, so I love
the whole part of the book is about how the meteorites that have fallen in New York and how they have been mysteriously mapped in a way that I won't talk about.
That was fun too to think about the meteorites because, quite frankly, when I went to the meteorites, I selected them as something that seemed entirely random. And I wanted to hold that up scientifically against religion. Look at this random pattern. Why are you making meaning out of it? And then
what humans, especially American humans, do.
But then I couldn't believe it when I actually did look at the map and they were all aligned along the Erie Canal and the Hudson River. And I thought, oh no, this is proving me wrong.
Well, let's look at cause and effect there. But anyway, so once you were in upstate New York and started and discovered or the wealth of this history of new religions and sects and all that in the 19th century, that was part of what prompted you to tell this story and set it there?
Yeah. I made a visit to Lilydale, the spiritualist community there, and that was completely inspiring. It's a Victorian-era summer camp where you go in the summer and people talk to the dead. And my favorite part of Lilydale is there's an outdoor amphitheater called Inspiration Stump. And twice daily, they bring in mediums, and the mediums just start channeling to whoever is there. And it's almost like an auction. I mean, it's kind of like, all right, I'm talking to Stephen. Wait, no, Stephen? Okay, here's Sophia. Does anybody have a Sophia out there who you're looking for? And it was amazing to me because I have to confess that as a writer of fiction, I identify with the con artistry of that practice.
Assuming they are also speakers of fiction.
Yeah, I don't believe in any of that. I don't believe that they're talking to the dead.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to one of these women and she said to me, she basically told me that my dead dad was sitting beside me. And I burst into tears and I couldn't stop crying for half an hour, despite the fact that I didn't believe her at all. And I thought, well, you know what? If that works as therapy, that was like 7 years worth of therapy in 45 minutes and it only cost me $60.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, which gets to so much of this book, that story, it seems to me, which is this kind of agnosticism you have about, is this real or is this not real? You know it's not real, but you're willing to imagine that it has the power of the real.
Yes, absolutely. And back to the dual part structure that you were talking about.
Yeah.
That was always my hope with the book, that I could argue both for belief on one side and against belief on the other side and never have to prove either and only just allow it to be a question that would stand for the reader, you know, to arrive at your own answer.
Well, at one point, the boy, Nat, who was the great talker to the dead, tells a disbeliever, I don't believe it, but that doesn't stop it from happening.
Absolutely. And I mean, and back to this idea of the power of fiction that affects me every single day, it's the same with the power of the dead in our lives, too. Do I believe that ghosts come and hide under my bed and jump out and say, boo? I do not. I know a lot of people who do, and I believe their belief, but it doesn't stop the dead person from affecting me every single day.
Sure.
So they don't exist. That doesn't matter to me. So these people are con artists. It doesn't matter to me. What they do still affects me. The books that I read still affect me. And I'm that's the kind of magic power that I'm talking about here, being affected by things that don't exist.
Right.
I mean, and I'm also interested in this idea that unexplainable things happen. And some people in my life try to convince me that they didn't happen. And some people, you know, just nod their head and
you mean things that happened to you?
Things that have happened, yes.
And like, give me an example of the most extreme.
Okay.
Whoa.
Okay.
One.
All right. One of my daughters, 3 years old, we drove by the site where someone had died in a car crash, and there was a memorial, and the cross said Billy. My daughter did not read at this point, and she looked at it. And she said, my other daughter said, what's that? And I hesitated because I didn't want to tell a sad story to them. And in my hesitation, my tiny daughter who didn't read said, that's where William died. I don't even know what to do with that.
Cast the demons out.
I don't even know what
Cast
to do.
Cast the devil out of her, Samantha.
Not Billy, as the sign said. So even if she could read,
yeah,
which she couldn't.
Yeah.
She called him William.
Is she a genius today?
And I said, I asked her, she's still only five, oh, but I asked her, I said, after I kind of recovered from the shock, and my husband was in the car too, so I have witnesses, you know, that I'm not an insane person. And I asked her how she knew that, and she said that the robot in her head told her.
And really, I know this wasn't a trick that your husband pulled by telling her earlier just to freak you out?
No, it was at a place that we'd not been.
Well, there you go. There you go. That's a mystery.
And so I'm interested in the idea of how we live with mysteries and how we just kind of say, okay, I'm just going to abide by that.
Yeah. This novel, among all three of yours, it seemed to me, because it has magic, it has suspense, it has these great characters, it is a mystery that one doesn't see the end coming. Seems like a great movie, or even better, like HBO series.
Ooh, fingers crossed.
Is there talk?
There is talk. Yep. There's been some. I mean, just in the early days. It only came out a few days ago, but hopefully, yes.
Well, good luck on that. I'll watch.
Thank you.
Sam, it has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Splitfoot is out right now.